You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. The Braves will be talking about the Alberto Carrasco-Juan Uribe trade and its many ramifications, as well as examining Julio Teheran's struggles. The Marlins will be having some more talk about the coaching staff and managerial situation. The Mets will be talking six-man rotation and checking on what David Wright's situation is. With the Phillies, we'll be taking a look at whether Ruben Amaro actually had a point with his comments earlier this week. And we'll talk Nationals. We'll be taking a look at Anthony Rendon, Yunel Escobar, and Steven Strasburg. Bill, it sounds like there's good news on Anthony Rendon. What's the latest on him? Where is he at?
The latest is he's playing simulated games and could be at a rehab assignment by this weekend. So that's the great news. Hopefully he'll be back within a week.
So it'll be quick. That, given the amount of time he's missed, I would have thought they might give him a decent number of at-bats. Are they planning for this to be a relatively quick thing on the rehab assignment?
Pretty much. And, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, so far so good. No pain in the oblique area. So we'll see what happens.
What are the expectations as far as, again, how he's going to kind of come along, less the health part? I mean, you don't really know about that, but the baseball part, well, first of all, at the plate, I mean, how many at-bats does he think that he needs to kind of get into game shape to be a competitive major league player?
Well, ironically, we haven't been able to talk to Rendon because for some reason he doesn't want to talk to us. I don't know if that's the Nationals doing, but the only thing that I have is what Matt Williams tells us. I just know that he'll be back with the team soon, and, you know, I think he'll be playing second base for the team.
Yeah, and that leads into the next thing I wanted to ask about. What are they doing? I mean, I know he's played plenty of second before. I know that's not new to him, but it's also a transition from what he's done recently and even what he was doing in spring training. What kind of work are they doing to make sure that when he comes back, he's sort of back up to speed as a second baseman defensively?
Well, he had a workout all last weekend, and in those 3 days, he just worked out at second base, and that's it. And that tells me right there that Escobar is going to stay at third, and then Rendon is going to remain at second base. And I think the transition is not going to be that bad. I mean, he did it last year. He started second last year and went to third without any problems. So I'm not seeing any problems here unless – there's a problem with his ankles. He's had ankle injuries in the past, but I don't see any problems.
Second base can be, it's difficult just baseball-wise, but from a health perspective, it can be a tricky position. You can be exposed to contact. There are a lot of different movements. It's a little odd to put a guy with health issues over there if you don't have to. What is their level of concern or alternately confidence about him staying healthy playing second base on a daily basis?
Well, I think it's more about Escobar than anything else, because if you remember, Escobar hurt his oblique, you know, making turns at second base, and I think he wants to stay there. I was told he wants to stay there. So I just think they believe that Rendon is healthy enough to play second base. And so far, based on what I saw, based on those 3 days, I mean, he was working it. He was really working it, hard. And there were no problems. And I see him just staying there for a while.
And why is that, that Escobar has that preference, given that he, as far as anybody knew, sort of signed on when he came that he was on board with playing second? What is it for him that makes third more desirable?
Well, they asked him to make the switch at third base, and he signed on for that. And you know, from what I understand, I don't know how true this is, but you know, playing third base is almost similar. It's the same area as playing shortstop. So, from what I understand, he really loves playing the position, and he wants to stay there. From what I understand,
how has he looked defensively to you at third base?
I think he's looked phenomenal, to be honest with you. I think he's done far more than I think anyone thought, because he had this reputation of being, selfish and everything. And I can tell you right now, he's not selfish as a member of the Nationals. He's been great. I have nothing but good things to say about him.
What do you think is behind that? Because as you know, this is a guy who came with some at least yellow flags as far as his makeup, his presence, that kind of thing.
I don't know. It could be people in the organization who really talked him into, you know, being a team player with the Nationals. There's one guy named, his last name is DePuglia. He's one of their Latin scouts, and he really talked to Escobar, and apparently that worked out. He agreed, because of him, he agreed to play second base. And then later, obviously, the Nationals went to him and asked him to play third, and he agreed to do that. So it's been smooth sailing ever since.
You can't help but wonder. This is a very aggressive front office, and one of the best players who might potentially be on the trade market between now and July 31st is a third baseman. I know they're awfully happy with Yoenel Escobar. I know they have him. I believe they have him beyond this year. Part of the thought here was that he might be the long-term shortstop. But given all that, with Rendon sliding over to second, do you think there's any chance at all that they at least put in a call on Adrian Beltre, who's the kind of player who could really be a difference maker both in the regular season and in October?
I do not. Maybe a couple of years ago, yes, no question. But no, I don't see it happening. I mean, they're winning with what they have right now. And, I mean, let's face it, Escobar is doing a great job. Even their second baseman right now, Danny Espinosa, is doing a great job. So I don't see a change. I'll be shocked if I see a change at third base or even anywhere in the infield.
And that you mentioned Espinosa, who's having a really nice year, Dan Uggla. There are a lot of infield pieces there. Just as far as the roster, what happens when Rendon comes back? How do they make those roster pieces beyond Rendon and Escobar? How do they make those roster pieces fit?
Well, obviously, I think Espinosa is going to be on the bench mostly. But I think, unlike in years past, I think he's going to be really a great player off the bench. I really believe that. I think Uggla's going to stay there. I think someone else will go. Who that will be, I don't know who that will be, but I don't think it will be, Uggla or even Espinosa for that matter. I think they'll be around the whole year.
All right. And then I wanted to revisit one more time because it remains a baffling story. Steven Strasburg continues to be searching, and it's really puzzling to see. What do you see? What did you see his last time out? Was it more of the same? Was it a different kind of struggle? He's been giving up home runs lately, which is something that even earlier this year he hasn't really done much of.
Matthew, I have to believe it's mechanical, because I'm telling you, his fastball is clocked at 98 miles an hour in his last start. His fastball was high as 98. I have to believe it's mechanical, and I think he's trying to fix something mechanical and also trying to fix himself mentally. He admitted to us after the game last week that it was a mental thing. He's not used to failure like this. So, I mean, he's got to get used to, he has to get some confidence back, and hopefully he can. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing I wonder is this is a something I got to think this guy hasn't seen since who knows when, maybe ever. What can the coaching staff, the organization do to just sort of help him handle this on the mental side? Because it's not something he's really ever had to deal with before.
I think a pat on the back, Matthew, and just keep working with Steve McCaddy. I mean, that's all McCaddy can do. I mean, you can't yell at him, obviously. I mean, if you talk to every pitcher on this team, they love McCaddy, because McCaddy always puts, his arm around them and say, hey, listen, you're good. Don't worry about it. You have one bad game. And you got to remember, too, McCaddy was a player himself. So, I mean, I think it helps that he was a player and, Strasburg can relate to what McCaddy's gone through in his own career. So we'll see what happens.
Was a pretty sensational day at Citi Field yesterday. Noah Syndergaard had a historic day. It's not an exaggeration. The combination of hits, home run, 7 1/3 shutout. And so we've talked about him a lot, and I kind of want to stretch it a little bit and talk about what he's kind of forced, which is this six-man rotation. It's gotten a lot of conversation. Is this something that they just sort of – is this an example of them kind of throwing up their hands because they don't know what a better way to handle this problem is, or is this something that they maybe anticipated doing back in the spring or before the season started?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something they anticipated, and not because of the whole too many pitchers for five spots thing. I think it's more of the too many pitchers who have question marks surrounding their health and their innings limits and all that sort of thing. They knew going into this year that Matt Harvey was going to be on an innings limit, a pretty strict one. They knew that Jacob deGrom was going to be on maybe a not as strict limit, but a limit nonetheless. They knew that John Neese was coming into this year with shoulder issues galore the past two seasons. They knew that Bartolo Colon, 42 years old, and so on and so forth. So you go down the line, and there were other ways they could have done this. It just seems right now, the way their personnel is, where Syndergaard is in his development, where Dylan G is coming back from injury, and so on and so forth, it just seems like the simplest fix for them. And we talked about this a little bit last week, but I think there's also a sense in the front office that, well, they say they're happy and willing to do this through August even, you know, as far as they need it. Chances are something's going to happen to make it not last that long. There could be an injury. There could be a trade. So while it's entirely conceivable this could go on for weeks and weeks and even months, I wouldn't necessarily count on it at this point.
Do you think that at this point they are at least pondering what their options are with Dylan G, not maybe actively shopping him, but at least sort of kicking around to see what's out there? Or is he – they just figuring they need him right now if they for as long as they can have him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they ever really stopped. They shopped Dylan G pretty hard this winter and at the end of the day weren't willing to necessarily give him away. They just didn't get an offer they liked. They had offers where they could have dumped him and the $5 million or so that he's making, but they weren't willing to do that without getting something of value in return. So I don't think a ton has changed in that regard. You know, Dylan G is still here. He's pitching reasonably well when he was healthy and has pitched reasonably well on his rehab. So, yeah, in a perfect world for the Mets, he'll come and he'll rejoin the rotation. He'll be the Dylan G that existed 2 years ago and will gain some of that trade value back. But in the short term, I'm just not sure there's enough value there that the Mets are willing to do that, unless they've changed their mindset and say, we will give him away for nothing. We have Steven Matz waiting in the wings, one of their top prospects who's every bit as highly regarded as Syndergaard. We have five other pitchers in the big leagues right now, and so on and so forth. It's certainly possible that thinking could change, and it could even change if these guys are still pitching well as we get into June, into July, towards the trade deadline. But for right now, I'm just not sure there's a return on investment out there that the Mets are really tempted by.
It was a lot of fun. Well, it's always fun to watch Bartolo Colon pitch, but he was got off to a really good start. And looked very much like holding on to him over the winter as opposed to not that they ever seriously considered shopping him, but he was clearly a guy they were right to hold on to as opposed to looking at moving him. Lately, he's been rough. He's gotten hit hard. His last start was a little better than the previous ones, but he's been less sharp lately. Home runs, walks, things that a guy who throws away he throws can't really afford to do. What are you seeing from Colon lately? Is this a blip or is this concerning, particularly given that we're talking about a guy who's now 42?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what you're seeing. You're seeing a 42-year-old pitcher who has a shadow of the stuff that he once had, and he can't make mistakes. You know, Noah Syndergaard can leave a ball over the middle of the plate, and it's probably going to get swung through more often than not. Bartolo Colon can't do that. And, you know, going out and making 30-something starts and having that pinpoint precision, while it might be easier for Colon than it is for other pitchers just because he's so good at it, it's not easy to have that every time out. So the Mets sort of knew what they were getting into with Colon both last year and this year. He's not going to blow people away. He's going to try and beat you by hitting his spots on the corners, changing speeds, making you swing at his pitches, and so on and so forth. It's not going to work every time. I think, you know, when you look up at the end of the year, as long as he stays healthy, he's going to have plenty of good starts. He's going to have plenty of bad starts, and you're probably going to look at a pretty similar season as what he put up last year, which is that low to mid four ERA, you know, winning something in the 12 to 14, 15 game region. And yeah, he's going to go through these rough patches. I don't think they're concerning. They're probably less concerning for him than they would be for any other pitcher, just because he's such a veteran. He knows exactly what he needs to do to fix it. For him, it's just a matter of physically executing it, which is going to work some days better than others.
All right. And turn to the other side of the ball. Been a lot of different takes on this announcement about David Wright's setback, and some people saying this is very, very worrisome. Some people saying, look, it's manageable. Asking you to play doctor here, what's your understanding of just how serious this latest setback and this latest diagnosis for David Wright is?
I mean, at this point, I don't think anyone knows quite how serious it is. The best way I could put it is this is an injury that has ended careers. This is an injury that guys have been able to play through. It really sounds like a type of thing where, you know, he's going to have to deal with this probably for the rest of his career, for the rest of his life. It's a matter of managing pain. It's a matter of treatment. And it seems like in Wright's case, it's not necessarily so far enough along that you have to worry about that ending his career, essentially, in his mid-30s. Of course, that's a possibility. Of course, it's never really affecting him as a possibility and everything in between. I think, you know, we're going to really need to see over the next couple of weeks, over the next couple of months, how he responds to rest, to rehab, and ultimately once he gets back out on the baseball field and starts doing baseball activities, which has not been the easiest go for him this season. It's just going to be a matter of touch and go and see how he responds to this stuff. I don't think anyone knows right now. I don't think David Wright knows right now. I think his doctors can give him the best guess, and everyone sort of around the Mets is downplaying the severity of it, but it is in the air. You start talking about the spine, you start talking in the back. It's worrisome, and I think we'll have much better answers in the next month or two than we do right now today.
Is there anything to be deduced at all right now just about time frame, or is it really just entirely up in the air for the time being?
Yeah, it's entirely up in the air. As long as he feels okay, he should start doing more rehab stuff in the coming week. But, you know, we've gone down this road with him before. He's been shut down twice now once he started doing baseball activities because he felt pain or discomfort or whatever you want to call it that both he and the Mets didn't anticipate. So while you can put a timetable on it, it's a dangerous game to do that only because you don't know when he's going to wake up and go out there on the field and feel something that he doesn't want to feel. You know, you're looking at a best case right now. If he was healthy tomorrow, he would still have to go through at least a week of baseball activities, probably at least a week of playing in games, and I would even tack on a few more days just because, you know, there's setbacks and there's things that you can't control. So we're at the end of May right now. I think the Mets would be thrilled to have him back by the end of June. Realistically, it could take a good deal longer than that.
They're obviously not going to go out and try and find a David Wright replacement, try and find a third baseman. So I'm not talking about that. It's not happening for a thousand reasons. But does this in any way, the sort of unknown, the worry about this, affect how they approach potential deals between now and the non-waiver trade deadline? Do they look maybe more aggressively than they might have for a bat, or is that not really on the table?
I think they're waiting and seeing a little bit. Just if it becomes apparent in the next week or two that David Wright's going to be okay, that he's going to be able to get back and conceivably help this team in July, they're not going to go out and make a big splash. They probably wouldn't go out and make a big splash anyways. I think what it does is it puts, and I wrote about this a little bit in an inbox I did for the website today, it puts some eyes on Matt Reynolds, their top shortstop prospect, who's not really a shortstop but has been playing there at Las Vegas. It puts some eyes on him because the Mets have some options. There's a lot of people within the organization who still think Daniel Murphy is better at third base than he is at second base, even at this point in his career. So if David Wright, they know, is going to be out for a matter of months as opposed to a matter of weeks, they could try and move Murphy to third base full-time, bring Reynolds out to play at second base, and that would give them some measure of flexibility. They still have Gilson Herrera as well, who can play second base, who is on the disabled list himself. But, I mean, you're looking at a lot of moving parts during that. Reynolds has not hit very well the past 2 or 3 weeks in Vegas, so he's going to have to start hitting for them to even consider something like that. But B, they're not going to disrupt a whole bunch of guys if they think David Wright is close. So I think, again, these answers are going to come the next week or two. I think they'll have a much better idea, the Mets will, where David Wright is at, how much time he needs, or at least some estimate of it, and then they'll start looking either internally or externally as far as solutions to replace them. Because, yeah, an offense without David Wright, they're going to need to do something because it's struggling without him right now.
Mark, the Braves have basically made podcast prep easier than any other team this year because there is always something right on tap to talk about. I'm going to start with how exactly this deal came to be. We'll talk about why later, but first I just want to ask how, given that it looked like a deal was on, and then it looked like a deal was off, and then it looked like a deal was on. That's something we usually hear on July 31st, not May 24th.
Yeah, well, you know, basically these two teams have been talking about prospects, you know, for probably a couple months. Not really nobody that ended up being involved in the deal, because I asked John Coppola yesterday, when he told me, hey, look, we've been talking for a while, I said, okay, so Chris Withrow, the right-handed reliever that they got in the deal, I said, so he's been on the radar for a while. He said, well, that really was just 2 weeks ago that he popped into it. And at the end of the day, you step back and take a look at this deal, that is the one, you know, piece that has a chance to have a long-term impact for either of these two teams. I know that the Dodgers, you know, are going to take a chance with Ian Thomas, or, you know, Ian Thomas as a starting pitcher now and that kind of stuff. But you know, this was a deal that all of a sudden that they started looking at Withrow. The Braves are saying, hey, look, we want to get rid of Kiaspo. The Dodgers wanted to get rid of the rebate to help from a financial standpoint with luxury tax and all that. Those two guys were the talk of the trade. And then, obviously, Kiaspo became a center, or the center of attention when he used his trade veto rights there Monday night when they first agreed upon this deal, and then obviously opted to reverse his decision when he got a little bit of financial motivation there with the trade stipend, and agreed to the deal, as we know, Tuesday night. And obviously after review there on Wednesday, Major League Baseball approved the deal. And you know, like I said, this is a deal where the Braves got rid of four guys who did not fit into their current or future needs. And they grabbed your rebate, who, you know, may stick around for the rest of the season, maybe one of the many guys they move here within the next couple months. But really what they did, this deal for them was all about getting taking a chance on Chris Withrow, the right-handed reliever, who they say has a chance to be, or he has closer type stuff. He will pitch, they hope he will pitch in the later innings in the next couple of years out of their bullpen. But, you know, like so many of the guys that they've targeted, they bought low on him because he's coming back from Tommy John surgery, had back surgery this past year. Let's see where he is when he comes back.
Do they consider the this year aspect of this more or less a wash, or do they think they may have bought low on Uribe as well and maybe have found something in him?
Maybe they found something. And one thing they definitely got in Uribe is a guy who's going to come in and shall be a good clubhouse figure. They have plenty of those right now. I mean, he's certainly not going to hurt the clubhouse. And from a third base perspective, he's still a really above average defender. How often can you play him every day? We'll see. You've got two right-handed third basemen now. You've got Chris Johnson and Uribe. Freddie Gonzalez is going to have to figure out how to keep both of them happy. I think what we'll see is probably the Braves have gone through a stretch here up until Monday and Tuesday where they faced Brett Anderson and Clayton Kershaw. They had faced one left-handed starter in a span of 30 games. You know, probably not going to see those kinds of stands anymore, but if you take a look at the National League East, you know, there aren't a lot of left-handed starters. So if you're just going to, you know, have a strict platoon there at third base with Johnson and Uribe, Johnson's not going to get much playing time. Now, the Braves have been trying to move Chris Johnson for, you know, basically back to October. That contract has been very tough to move. They've offered to eat some money. I know that a lot of people were saying, hey, you know, the Braves are in San Francisco now. Go ahead and trade one of these third basemen here to the Giants, who are obviously looking for they're going to give Duffy a chance here, but they might be looking for a third baseman. The Giants are one of the teams that have said no to Chris Johnson in the past. So you know, the Braves want to try to increase his value any way they can, so they're going to mix and match the opportunities they put him in the lineup, trying to figure out the best opportunities for him to succeed and get his numbers up. With Uribe, you know, if they get to a point where in July they're 500 or slightly below, I'd say he could be one of the many veterans that gets moved during that month. I'd say that month has a chance to be a condensed version of the hectic offseason, which we all saw the Braves create this past winter.
Talk about some guys who are already there. Julio Teheran remains baffling because every time it looks like he's put a couple of good starts together and he's getting it together, he goes out and has a clunker. I watched the last one, and I still couldn't tell you what happened because it was good, and then it was real, real bad. What is going on with Teheran?
You know, the start before, let's go back 3 years. Let's go back to Julio Teheran as a promising or highly regarded prospect, one of the game's top prospects, where he's throwing 94, 95 with the good slider. You know, you're saying, hey, look, this guy has a chance to have plus-plus stuff at the big league level. His rookie year, he was more around 92, 93. Last year, we saw more of the 88, 91. And that's basically what we've seen this year. Last week against the Brewers, when he was so effective, probably just because it was a rather weak lineup, he, all of a sudden that velocity went down. We saw 85, 86. That affected his average velocity. You know, average fastball velocity that game was 88. Now, he did pop a couple 88, 91s, you know, or most part, he sat there during the latter innings. But early on, he was struggling to generate velocity. But I'm not sure the velocity is as much a concern when you look over the entire season. His struggles is just he cannot command his pitches right now. The left-handed hitters, the sinker is you know, he's trying to throw it on the corner of the plate. He's leaving it out over the middle. You've got an on-base percentage against left-handers of about 450 right now. You know, if you take a step back and you say, hey, look, you've got Shelby Miller for 4 years, you feel good about Alex Wood, Mike Foltynewicz, Whistler, I'd say, you know, let's say, okay, I'm going to throw out the opinion, you know, they should trade him now. And someone said, well, you're selling low on him right now. Well, from what I've seen, I don't know if it's not going to go lower because I don't have a lot of faith in, you know, him turning them around based on what I've seen, not only this season, but parts of the latter part of last year. Just the stuff is not, you know, overpowering. He's certainly not going to be that dominating ace type. Maybe he's a solid number three or number four. I just don't know where that value is going. So for those who say you'd be selling low on him now, I say, well, you might be selling lower on him if you keep him, you know, throughout this season.
Do you get the impression that even if they haven't gotten that far, the club has adjusted its sort of not only short-term but long-term view of him?
I think that the one adjustment I think the club has made is they've accepted the fact that he's not going to be that number. You don't want to look at him as your number one for the future. Like I said, Foltynewicz and Shelby Miller are the two guys I'd say have the, right now from what we've seen, those are the two guys that you could build your rotation around. And you know, Alex Wood, hey, look, you might look at his stuff and say it's not the overpowering, you know, prototypical ace-type stuff, but, you know, you like his competitive nature. And his pitches work. I mean, now he's made some mechanical adjustments. His sinker and changeup are quite effective. But, you know, the game that we watched him pitch there against Greinke this week, that was Alex Wood, the Alex Wood that we saw during the latter part of last year. I think he is a guy who you can rely upon or have confidence that he will be a solid number two or number three for many years to come. And like I said, now all of a sudden you've got three, as long as Foltynewicz continues to make the progress he has over the last couple of weeks, that's a pretty good base for rotations to be built on for the future. And I'd put Teron behind those three guys right now. So, and with the guys that you have coming still with, whether Manny Valenzuela ends up being an effective starter at the big league level remains to be seen. Same with Matt Whistler. But you have so many options coming. I think I might take a chance on moving Teron instead of just saying, hey, you know, he's just going to be a guy that's going to fit in, be that number three or number four for many years to come.
Joe, this team seems incapable of going more than a week or two without making some headlines that sort of make you raise your eyebrows a little bit. Most recent was this odd sequence of events with the coaching staff, where first there were reports that Brett Butler had resigned, and then we learned that he was in uniform, and then we learned that he had been reassigned. What was the sequence of events? What happened here that led to all this confusion, and what led to Brett Butler being reassigned and Lenny Harris being moved to be the third base coach?
Well, it comes down to a missed sign, kind of a botched hit-and-run situation in Monday's game at Pittsburgh, and apparently it wasn't the first time such an incident has happened with sign confusion dating back to when Mike Redmond was managing. And, you know, after evaluating the whole situation, the Marlins decided to change that up. I mean, keep in mind, Dan Jennings, the manager, is trying to use these first couple of weeks to kind of sort things out and try to put everyone in positions to succeed. And obviously just more distraction and just, more bad headlines for the Marlins and, more head scratching inside the clubhouse. But, they're going this route where Brett Butler will be in the dugout. You know, he's still the outfield and base running, bunting coach, but clearly not a comfortable situation to have a demoted, coach on your staff, a guy who was your third base coach last year as well. So, who knows? Who knows if this means it's a short-term thing and there'll be another coaching position move? You don't know. All you know is with every mounting loss, there seems to be another crisis that comes to the forefront. And this organization right now and these players need stability more than continued uncertainty.
I guess what I wonder when I look at a situation like this is it seems like there's one of two possibilities. Either they made a move based on one or two occurrences, which seems pretty drastic, or there was a pattern, in which case I wonder why you don't just make this move at the time when they make the other moves to the coaching staff. So, where on that continuum is it? Was it really one thing that was that bad that they made a move? Was it an ongoing thing, or maybe it could have been done sooner?
I think it's an ongoing thing, and I think there could be, a little bit of disagreement in philosophy and in temperament and all the other stuff with, Brett Butler and the rest of the team. So, you start hearing stuff without specifics, but you hear their incidents and, who knows what's going on in meetings, what's being said in evaluations and in interpretations. But, clearly, Matt, let's make this clear. I mean, the Marlins came back from that West Coast road trip and then get swept by the Braves. And even before they took the field on Sunday, they knew Mike Redman was out, you know, and they didn't interview anybody but Dan Jennings. So much has been hastily put together in terms of just changing the manager and bench coach that I don't think a lot of thought was given into the complete fallout and, you know, what this, you know, I don't know if they thought everything through and whether or not, you know, they needed to make additional, if they were going to make changes, you know, additional changes, you know, and if this thing falls apart, what if there's another manager move? So, you know, they've really boxed themselves into a bad spot right now.
On top of all this, and there's another kind of odd occurrence here. Last week, there was a charitable event where it was expected that players would be there, and players were not there. And there were a couple different takes on it. There was some speculation that it might be some kind of protest. Basically, everybody around the organization just said, look, well, these guys are beat, they're losing, they're not happy, they're not in any mood to glad hand. What was your understanding of what happened on that day?
Yeah, I think it was just kind of the perfect storm with a charity event right there. You know, I think they had a noon game at home, and that event was at about 7 o'clock, so it would have meant players after a tough loss, you know, going back home and then coming back to the park in the midst of a 7-game losing streak and a new manager. And, you know, obviously, some players are saying it wasn't a concerted, decision to do it that way. The organization said it was voluntary, and then, you know, kind of said they, you know, David Sampson's quote was some of the fact that their job extends past the 27th out. Read between the lines, you would think that, you know, the players kind of said, we're not going, and everyone to a man kind of agreed. So whether it was a protest or not, you know, I think those who kind of think it was, I think they're pretty safe in believing that, you know. Now, if it was a protest, is it against Dan Jennings? Is it against the front office? Is it against, you know, how things happen with Red? Who knows? I think, you know, like I said last week, the players have been receptive to giving Jennings a shot. You know, they all like him. You know, they've liked him as the GM. So I don't think it was that front. So I think you're looking at, you know, kind of a little protest thing. I kind of hope when everything dust settles, they kind of reschedule some sort of event where, you know, everyone's in a little bit better mood and kind of, you know, pay back those fans for that night. I kind of hope that something along the lines is being thought of to say, look, you know, everyone's to kind of blame on this one. Timing wasn't right. Players still should have shown up, especially those who had committed, and just kind of do something good and move forward without yet another distraction.
And it kind of raises a question to me, because you've mentioned a couple times that, you know, Jennings himself is popular in the clubhouse, that the players don't have any issue with him. But it does seem like there's some discontent. Is it about Redman being let go? Is it just about sort of how chaotic it's been? If they're happy with the guy, what is the dissatisfaction about? Or is it just because they're losing and they're happy to lose?
It's like, Matthew, I think it's kind of simple. It's like DJ's never had cleats, you know, dirt in the cleats, you know, that old expression. He never played the game. He never coached or managed. So every move he makes, while, you know, it's up to, you know, subject to scrutiny on every talk show and, you know, national broadcast and every writer, and that's all fair game. They put him in that, and they put themselves in that spot. So, you know, some of the stuff that everyone on the outside is questioning, the players are looking. You know, players are looking to DJ for leadership. They are looking to see how he manages the game in terms of strategy. And there was a double switch early on that kind of confused even some of his supporters in the clubhouse. So, he doesn't have that experience of making those, you know, quick decisions. And, you know, I will say since that, he seems to be managing pretty well these last few games. As he's put his players in position to succeed, they've kind of let him down, those who've been put there. So I don't think you can really fault the manager for what's going on. And I think, you know, some growing pains and some is totally expected. But if it looks to the players ultimately like this isn't a big league team, then there's going to be a real problem, and you're going to have to make yet another manager move and, you know, kind of gracefully get DJ back up in into the front office where he's best, you know, that's where he's best suited. Matthew, if it's me, he's, you know, I wait, you know, to kind of see if they could get a little bit on the roll, get things going. But this organization, in my opinion, is better with Dan Jennings being the general manager. And why I say that is he is, you know, such a leader and dominant force in the organization in terms of, you know, going out and scouting players for potential trade, having input in the draft, you know, which now he has none in the draft right around the corner. So, you know, he won't be out there watching, you know, players that he had watched a year ago, you know, and was very instrumental in them putting together a pretty good draft. You know, running this organization obviously is more than managing for 3 hours and managing 25 players in uniform. And I don't think, as an organization, the Marlins right now have strengthened themselves because they kind of weakened themselves in the front office and, you know, put DJ in a have to learn on the fly in the dugout. And if the season's going to look like it's going to be towards more rebuilding than contending, then get somebody in here to get the rest of the season going and get DJ back in doing what he's done best. So I wouldn't be shocked if we see yet another manager change at some point before the All-Star break.
Todd, I think you would agree, I would agree, fans would agree, I think Ruben Amaro would agree, that he probably had a couple of ill-chosen words and one ill-chosen sentence in the interview that he got a lot of heat for recently. But I want to ask, as far as philosophically, did he kind of have a point when it comes to fans' expectations, prospects, and managing prospects in a season like this?
Yeah, I do. And he acknowledged as much yesterday. He's like, you know, people are going to kind of miss my message because I said some foolish things. And really the message makes sense, which is you don't want to rush these guys right now. There's no reason to rush these guys. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, well, the Phillies never promote their players quickly. They always develop them too slowly. And so I looked at it a little bit yesterday, and Aaron Nola, who everybody wants to see in the big leagues, or you know, some sort of I don't know if it's a minority, a loud minority, or a majority of fans. He's made 20 starts in his professional career. I was looking at other first-round draft picks in recent seasons and how many starts those guys have made, from Matt Harvey to David Price to Lance Lynn to several other guys, and they were anywhere between 30 to 50 to 70 starts in the minor leagues before they finally got promoted. Now there's the Steven Strasburgs of the world, you know, Leafs of the world, those types of guys. But the fact of the matter is you don't want to rush your prospects to the big leagues. You want to take special care with them. You want to make sure they're fully developed, ready to handle it physically and emotionally. And in a season like this, you really have all the time in the world. And I know people want it to get turned around quickly, but, you know, it's not going to happen this season. It's probably not going to happen next season. And for that reason, you can afford to kind of take your time with these guys and allow them to develop, whether it be a pitcher or a position player. Just let them kind of go at their own pace. Because, again, if you want the Phillies to bounce back and be competitive again for an extended period of time, you want to make sure that you handle these guys correctly. And again, that means taking it at their own pace. No reason to rush these guys right now.
I guess that's kind of what I'm looking at. I mean, as you note, Nola is not, I don't even think he is a Strasburg type, a Scherzer
right.
type. I mean, I don't think anybody, and tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think anybody sees him as a number one guy in a playoff series kind of guy. He looks like a good major league starter and probably will be ready pretty quickly. But, you know, I don't get the impression that he's a guy, he's a Matt Harvey. When he arrives, suddenly people are going to flood the ballpark just to see him pitch. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, what do they see from him? Is that kind of an accurate read on him?
That is an accurate read. You know, mostly what you hear from scouts is, you know, he could be a good number three type of starter in the rotation. You know, maybe he'll exceed those expectations and be a little bit better. But I have not come across anybody inside or outside the organization that says, we've got our next Cole Hamels here. This is our next. This we've got our next Roy Halladay here. They think he's going to be a good, solid, big league starting pitcher. But you're right. You know, you mentioned Matt Harvey. I think he had like 30 minor league starts, and Max Scherzer had like 30 minor league starts, or maybe more. So this guy is not Steven Strasburg. You know, but he has talent. So I imagine he will be up at some point this year, possibly September, maybe even a little bit earlier. But there is no kind of this wait till this guy comes on the scene. You're right. You're not going to all of a sudden have Aaron Nola make his first start, and there's going to be 45,000 people at Citizens Bank Park, or a second, or a third, or a fourth. You know, it's going to be exciting to see him up there. I know a lot of people are excited to see him. I am excited to see him, but I think people kind of need to lower their expectations a little bit about what exactly it's going to mean.
Are there guys at AAA in particular? We know there are some very interesting prospects, or a guy like Crawford. Are there guys in the upper level of the system who are really knocking on the door? I mean, who's kind of next? Franco's there, and he was really the guy who looked like he was ready. Who's next? Is there somebody else that's kind of knocking on the door for the minors to be a part of this big league club?
Yeah, to be honest, nobody that you could say will be up in the next couple weeks or in the next month. And that's the thing. Most of the Phillies' prospects right now are in Double A, High A, Lakewood, Class A Lakewood, those types of places. So nobody that's really totally knocking on the door. Now, if you talk about AAA, the most intriguing guys are Cody Ashby and Dominic Brown. When are they going to come up at some point and get a chance to prove themselves in the Phillies' outfield? But in terms of guys knocking on the door, Felipe Aumont has been very intriguing now that he's returned to the rotation in AAA. But nobody that you look at and say, okay, you got Franco up here now, plug this guy in the left field, boom, and you got your left side of the field locked down for the next 8 or 10 years.
And then you talk about guys who are given an opportunity. I mean, you look at this is a terrible segue, so I'm just going to ask. I tried to make it work, and it's just not going to work. What's going on with Odubel Herrera? Because those numbers are pretty ugly. After being a real spark plug and a bright spot early, his numbers have really kind of come crashing down.
Yeah, they have. And I think the Phillies hope that what is happening here is just a young player who wouldn't be in the big leagues if he wasn't a Rule 5 draft pick, trying to find his way, hitting some struggles, hitting a wall a little bit. And I think they're hoping that he will continue to make adjustments and swing his way out of it. And, if the Phillies had acquired him in a trade in the offseason, he would probably be in Double A or Triple A right now. But he's a Rule 5 guy. He's got to be in the big league roster. And the Phillies think, you know what, we've got nothing to lose. Let's keep putting him out there on a daily basis and really give him a good, thorough test. Because in Double A, they have Roman Quinn. So, you know, they want to start trying to figure out, okay, you know, is a rarer guy we could see in the outfield down the road? Is he a part-time player? Is he a full-time player? And that's what the season is going to be for him.
Is the long-term read on Herrera changing at all, or are they still as optimistic as ever about him sort of going forward?
I think they're optimistic about him, but I don't know if they look at him as the everyday guy. Like, Pat Gillick has said 2017, 2018, before the Phillies start contending again. I don't know if they're convinced that in 2018 – when the Phillies take the field on opening day, that Odubel Herrera is going to be the Phillies' center fielder. Now, he might be, but they have, like I said, Roman Quinn in Double A. He's shown a lot of potential this season. So they think they might have some options, and I think they're keeping their minds open and their eyes open about what could be down the road.
Standing next to him many days in the outfield is Ben Revere. You mentioned that Revere might not be going anywhere. It was only one move, but one of the clubs that might have been interested in him is now out of the picture. What is the latest with Revere? Do you expect him to be with this club for an extended period of time, or is he still one of the guys who might be finding a new address sooner than later?
I still think that they're still going to try to trade him, and you never know. Maybe the Angels look at the trade they just made as kind of a short-term solution until they maybe work out something bigger and better. not that Ben Revere is bigger and better in terms of a power source or anything, but by any means, but he probably gives you a little bit more offense. So I think they still want to move him because they still look at this team and they say, okay, Ashley and Brown are going to be up at some point. We need to find room for these guys. And we just talked about Herrera and how they kind of want to give him a real good chance to prove himself this season. So if Herrera is going to stay in center field and Ashley and Brown come up at some point, now you have somewhat of a valuable asset in Ben Revere sitting on the bench. So, you know, going back to what you said earlier, while they might not be totally convinced that Odubel Herrera will be the opening day center fielder in 2018, I think they're definitely under that impression with Ben Revere. I don't believe that they look at him and see him in this on the Phillies roster in a couple seasons.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks everybody for listening.